Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 109.
And to really understand what's happening, I want you to pay close attention to the stark contrast between two parallel storylines that are basically colliding in real time.
Right, because you have these two very different worlds existing simultaneously.
Exactly. On one hand, you have the younger generation, and they are completely insulated in the inner quarters. They are consumed by these poetic, spiritual obsessions. I mean, they are chasing ghosts and dissecting their own dreams.
And then on the other side?
On the other side, you have the older generation. And they are dealing with the cold, hard, terrifying realities of physical illness, domestic abuse, and like the massive logistical burden of running a failing estate.
Those two spheres, you know, the poetic inner world and the pragmatic outer world, they are completely distinct, yet they operate under the exact same roof. And the real tension comes from watching how they begin to bleed into one another.
So let's start with the inner world, because the psychological drama happening in here is just intense.
It's a lot.
It is. So we have Baoyu, who is essentially drowning in this unresolvable grief. The woman he truly loved, Dayu, has recently died. But his grief has fixated on one very specific, almost technical detail.
Right, the dreams.
Yes, he cannot dream about her. He hasn't had a single dream of Dayu since she passed. And his new wife, Baochai, she's observing all of this. She sees this obsession.
He knows exactly what is keeping him distant from her.
She does.
Here.
But she doesn't, you know, sit him down for a therapeutic conversation about moving on or whatever. Instead, she stages an intervention that is wildly calculated.
It's a masterclass in psychological leverage, honestly. Baochai understands that a direct confrontation would be disastrous.
Because he would just get defensive, right?
Exactly. If she were to demand that he stop mourning Dayu and focus on their marriage, she would only validate his grief. He would become defensive and he'd likely double down on his sorrow just to prove the purity of his love.
Right, like, you don't understand how much I loved her.
Exactly. Direct opposition creates friction, and friction creates heat. And that would only fuel his obsession. So she basically bypasses his rational, defensive faculties entirely.
Which is so sneaky.
It is. She stages a conversation with a senior maid, Shiren, speaking just loudly enough for Baoyu to overhear from the next room.
And the argument she makes in this staged conversation is fascinating. She tells the maid that Dayu wasn't just a human. Right? She was an immortal being who had temporarily descended to Earth.
Right, playing right into his own beliefs.
Yeah. And because Dayu is an immortal, she naturally views living mortals as, quote, filthy creatures or turbid things.
Which is a harsh way to put it, but it works perfectly.
It totally does. Yeah. Therefore, Baochai concludes loudly, Dayu wouldn't ever bother lowering herself to visit the dream of a mortal. The dead have ascended, and they simply do not care about the trivial, muddy obsessions of the living.
The sheer brilliance of this tactic is that it uses Baoyu's own cosmology against him. You know, Baoyu holds this deeply romanticized, almost mystical view of the world, especially regarding Dayu.
He practically worships her memory.
He does. So Baochai doesn't try to pull him into cold reality. Instead, she steps into his delusion and creates a logical loophole within it.
Oh, that's such a good way to put it.
She essentially establishes a premise. If Dayu is the pure goddess you believe her to be, then by your own poetic logic, she is too pure to visit your muddy, mortal mind. She weaponizes his own spiritual romanticism to sever his attachment.
Okay, I look at this and I have to ask, isn't this just a very eloquent form of gaslighting?
Well,
we are watching a spouse deliberately trick her husband by planting a fake conversation for him to overhear.
Oh.
She's manipulating his deepest spiritual beliefs to erase his grief. If a spouse did this today, we would absolutely call it toxic manipulation.
We probably would, yeah.
So is there a line here between advanced grief management and outright cruelty?
It's a really valid question, but we have to view this through the lens of survival within the Jia household.
Mm.
In Baochai's reality, Baoyu's grief is not just a sad emotional state, it is a systemic threat.
A threat to what, exactly?
Yeah. Well, it threatens his physical health, his mental stability, and crucially, it threatens the stability of their marriage. And that marriage is the sole foundation of her future security in this patriarchal structure.
Ah, right. She has no other safety net.
Exactly. She isn't acting out of malice. She is performing emergency triage. In a society where open communication about messy, unregulated emotions is practically forbidden, manipulation often becomes the primary language of care.
Wow. Manipulation is the language of care. That is incredibly dark.
It is, but she amputates the obsession to save the patient, essentially.
And the staggering part is that it works. I mean, Bayou overhears this, and he completely buys into the logic. He actually thinks, she's right, I haven't had a dream because I am just a filthy mortal.
He totally accepts it.
So he makes a decision to change his physical environment. He decides to sleep in the outer room away from his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He rationalizes that if he purifies himself, if he shows absolute quiet sincerity in this separate space, maybe Dayu's spirit will see his true heart and grant him one single dream.
It's a very transactional view of spirituality.
It really is.
Yeah.
He even makes an internal bargain. Like, he tells himself if he gets zero dreams after doing all this purifying, he will finally accept that she's ignoring him and he will let her go.
The spatial dynamics here are critical to understand. You know, by moving from the inner bedroom to the outer room, he is attempting to create a controlled laboratory condition for a supernatural event.
A laboratory for a ghost.
Exactly. He is trying to force a spiritual visitation through sheer willpower and physical reorganization. It really highlights that transactional nature of his grief you mentioned. He genuinely believes he can negotiate with the spiritual realm if he just sets up the right parameters.
Yeah, he thinks if he sets up his sleeping bag in the hallway, the ghost is contractually obligated to appear.
Right.
But his attempt to commune with the spirits doesn't lead to a ghost. It leads to a jarring collision with a living person, which plunges us right into a masterclass on psychological projection and trauma.
This scene is so hard to read, honestly.
It is. So in the dead of night, Baoyu wakes up in the outer room and he asks for water. A junior maid named Wuer brings it to him. Now, Wuer has just woken up in a hurry. She's wearing only a peach-red silk jacket with her hair loosely tied.
Which is an important visual detail.
Very. Because in the dim light, dressed exactly like this, Wuer looks identical to Kingwin. So when he sees Wuer in that specific dim light wearing only a light silk jacket, his quote-unquote foolish nature violently flares up. He doesn't see Wuer at all.
Not even a little bit.
He projects the dead Kingwin onto her. He starts acting highly inappropriately, grabbing her hand, and then he frantically tries to force his own white silk padded jacket onto Wuer. He's insisting she wear it so she doesn't catch a cold. I mean, he is completely detached from the present reality.
This is a profound trauma response. His brain is attempting to rewrite history right in front of him. When he sees a girl who looks like Kingwin in the exact same physical vulnerability and underdressed in the cold night, he tries to retroactively save the dead maid by forcing the warm jacket onto the living one.
It's heartbreaking, but it's also terrifying for Wuer.
It is. He is desperately trying to heal his past trauma through a non-consensual present action. It is an instinctual, almost violent attempt to correct a historical failure.
And think about the absolute terror this causes Wuer. We really have to map the power dynamics here because they're so skewed.
Very skewed.
Wuer is a junior maid. And the source actually notes that she used to harbor a romanticized idea of Bayou, right? She wanted to work in his inner circle. She had a little crush.
She thought it would be this poetic, wonderful life.
Exactly. But the reality of it shatters that illusion instantly. She sees her master acting completely unhinged, calling her by a dead girl's name, grabbing at her. She knows the strict, unforgiving rules of this aristocratic household.
She knows exactly what's at stake.
If they are caught in this compromising position, Bayou might get, like, a stern talking to or reprimand. But Wuer will be utterly destroyed. She would be fired, disgraced, or honestly, much worse.
It perfectly illustrates the massive disparity in privilege here. Bayou is allowed to inhabit this poetic, trauma-induced fantasy world. He has the luxury of losing his mind over ghosts.
Because he's the master.
Right. Wuer does not have that luxury. She is living in a perilous social reality where a single misstep or even a misunderstanding thrust upon her by her master means total ruin. She's navigating a minefield of literal survival while he is just wandering through an emotional dreamscape.
The disconnect is so severe, it almost borders on dark comedy. I mean, Baoyu tells Wuer in complete earnestness that he is sleeping out in the outer room because he is trying to meet an immortal.
And of course, he has no idea what he's talking about.
Right. Bauer hears this and naturally assumes it's an incredibly creepy, cheesy pickup line. She thinks he is metaphorically calling his wife and his senior maids immortals, and now he's trying to flirt with her. They're having two entirely different conversations.
It is a total failure of empathy disguised as romanticism. Baoyu is so consumed by his internal feelings for the dead that he is completely blind to the tangible terror and discomfort he is causing the living person standing right in front of him.
While Baoyu is wrapped up in ghosts and lookalikes, Bao Chai She coughs loudly just once.
Such a power move.
Just a single cough. It's a clear signal that she is awake, which terrifies Wur into fleeing and immediately shuts the incident down. But Bao Chai's real strategic brilliance reveals itself the very next day.
Because Bao Chai realizes that her initial tactic, the psychological inception about the immortal Dayu, well, it was almost too effective.
Yeah, it backfired a bit.
It did. It successfully cured him of hoping for a dream, but it violently triggered what the text defines as his old illness, which is his tendency to become overly attached to the women and maids in his immediate physical vicinity.
Right. He just swapped one obsession for another.
Exactly. He simply transferred his unregulated obsession from the dead Dayu to the living Wur. So Bao Chai has to pivot.
She decides she must use, quote, obsession to cure obsession. And the execution is just flawless. So the next night, Bao Yu, who is likely feeling super awkward and guilty about the whole Wur incident, says he wants to sleep in the outer room again.
And how does she react?
Well, Bao Chai doesn't argue. She doesn't raise her voice or demand an explanation. She simply agrees. But she does so with this slightly cold, subtle, silent treatment. And crucially, she agrees with another maid's suggestion to move Siren, the senior maid, who usually watches over Bao Yu, out of the outer room and into the inner room with her.
This specific maneuver requires us to really understand the role of a senior maid like Siren in this culture.
Yeah, what does that signify?
Siren isn't just a servant. She is a supervisor, a caretaker, and basically a physical safety net for Bao Yu. By agreeing to remove Siren from the outer room, Bao Chai is stripping away the infrastructure that allows Bao Yu to comfortably play out his melancholy.
Oh, I see.
She is essentially saying, you want to be alone with your ghosts. Fine, you will be entirely alone.
So by yielding to his request with this icy, disappointed detachment, she forces Bao Yu to look at himself. She pretends that the inner and outer rooms are exactly the same to her, signaling that his physical presence is no longer highly valued.
Which hits him right in the ego.
It really does. This forces him to confront his own bad behavior. He suddenly realizes he is neglecting his living, breathing, incredibly patient wife just to chase ghosts and harass terrified maids in the hallway.
She weaponizes his own conscience against him. Bao Chai recognizes that Bao Yu is fundamentally a creature of emotion, not logic. You know, you cannot argue him out of his grief, but you can overwrite one strong emotion with an even stronger one.
And in this case, she uses guilt.
Exactly. By removing the friction, by essentially saying, do whatever you want, I am taking the staff and going to bed, she removes the romantic resistance he was pushing against. The outer room is no longer a poetic site of spiritual purification. It becomes just a cold room where he is acting like a terrible husband.
And the guilt becomes completely overwhelming for him. He breaks. He feels deeply ashamed. He packs up his things, abandons the ghost hunt entirely, and moves back into the inner room to comfort her.
He comes crawling back.
He does. And the text is incredibly explicit about the result of this maneuver. It states that because Bao Yu feels this deep regret and desire to comfort her, and because Bao Chai has successfully drawn him back in, they achieve true intimacy. The phrase used in the source is like water and fish.
A very classic metaphor for a marital harmony.
Yeah, it's the consummation of their marriage, both emotionally and physically.
Bao Chai has literally engineered a stable, functioning reality out of a chaotic psychological mess. It is the ultimate victory of pragmatism over romanticism.
But let's look closely at what that actually means for you and me reading this today. I mean, is a consummation built on orchestrated guilt, psychological chess, and redirected obsession actually a real marriage?
It's a tough pill to swallow.
It is. We are watching a relationship fundamentally built on one partner successfully managing the delusions of the other. It really exposes how, in this environment, true uncalculated romance is seen as a liability.
Uncalculated romance gets people killed in this world. I mean, we saw that with King Wynn. Calculated, managed affection is the only safe way to exist here. Bao Chai's actions aren't romantic in any modern sense, but they are fiercely protective of her own survival.
She's just doing what she has to do.
Right. She is securing her place in a hierarchy that is otherwise highly unstable.
And speaking of unstable, that instability within the inner chambers is absolutely nothing compared to what's happening outside them.
Oh, the shift in tone here is massive.
It's huge. Because just as Bao Yu and Bao Chai finally solidify their union, the very foundation of the entire family structure begins to crack. We move from the micro drama of the bedroom to the macro tragedy of the household. The absolute head of the family, Jia Mother, begins to fail.
The atmosphere of the text shifts dramatically here. The claustrophobic focus on dreams and maids expands into a terrifying view of systemic institutional collapse.
It really does. and it starts with a transfer of power. Grandmother Jia calls Baoyu over to her room. Now, she is pleased with him lately, ironically believing he has been showing great filial piety, completely unaware of the psychological warfare that just concluded in his bedroom.
She has no idea what he's actually been up to.
None at all. And because she was pleased, and because Baoyu had previously lost his own famous jade, she decides to give him something extraordinary. She gives him an ancient piece of Han Dynasty jade.
The physical description of this object in the source is highly specific, and it's important. It is 3 inches round, shaped like a sweet melon, and possesses a distinct red halo.
On the history she reveals about it is critical. She tells Baoyu that this jade was given to her by her own grandfather 60 years ago.
60 years.
Yeah, when she was just a young woman preparing to be married. She has kept it locked away, hidden at the very bottom of a box for 6 entire decades. She has never worn it, and now suddenly she brings it out and hands it to her grandson.
It's a huge moment.
It makes me think of, like, a corporate CEO who knows the company's about to declare bankruptcy. Before the auditors arrive and freeze all the accounts, the CEO quietly transfers the last pristine, untouchable stock options to a favored junior employee. It's a localized wealth transfer meant to bypass the coming collapse.
That is a highly functional analogy. The jade represents an era of deep stability, ancient wealth, and unbroken lineage. You know, the connection to the Han Dynasty implies a foundational, almost mythic past.
It's not just a pretty rock.
Exactly. The fact that it has been locked away for 60 years means it was preserved during the family's long summer of prosperity. Bringing it out into the light now is a deeply ominous signal.
Like breaking the glass in an emergency.
Yes. It suggests that the absolute deepest reserves are being tapped. The matriarch instinctively knows she must pass this physical mantle before the institutional framework of the family dissolves entirely.
And there's a fascinating, really quiet moment of generational tension when she gives it to him. She says to Baiyu, "Your father will probably say it's better to love a grandson than a son."
She knows exactly what she's doing there.
She totally does. She knows her own son, Baiyu's father, will be jealous or critical of this gift.
This exposes the complex, competitive, and deeply hierarchical layers of affection in Confucian familial structures. Love, favor, and resources do not flow evenly.
It's not a democracy.
Not at all. They are concentrated and bestowed based on dynastic hope. By bypassing her son to anoint her grandson, Grandmother Jia disrupts the immediate chain of command. Even in a moment of supposed generosity, she is breeding resentment and highlighting the fault lines in the family's power structure.
And the timing of this gift is chilling. Shortly after she hands over the jade, her body starts to fail. She stops eating. She feels a heaviness in her chest. She gets dizzy and falls gravely ill. And the response of the family's medical infrastructure is just pathetic.
It reveals the total inadequacy of the systems they rely on, which is a classic symptom of a failing state.
It's so bad. The doctors come in, they check her pulse, and they essentially diagnose her with a tummy ache.
A tummy ache for a dying woman.
Right. They say she just ate too much rich food and caught a little draft. They prescribe some basic digestive medicine for an actively dying matriarch.
This initial medical denial is a psychological self-preservation mechanism for the family. The people in charge, the doctors, the sons, they cannot fathom that the central pillar of their universe is actually crumbling.
It's too terrifying to admit.
So they minimize the threat. They classify a terminal systemic failure as a temporary minor inconvenience. It ensures that the matriarch receives entirely the wrong care, but it allows the family to pretend for just a few more hours that the world isn't ending.
But the world is ending. And the protective bubble that has always shielded the Jia family violently bursts. Horrifying news from the outside world begins to flood in. It's like the gates have been breached.
The reality of the outside world is crashing down on them.
We move now into the brutal pragmatism of grief. And the contrast between how Baiyu mourned a dream, you know, just a few nights ago, and how the family reacts to actual literal death is shocking.
The text establishes a very clear, very cruel hierarchy of grief here, dictated by the rules of filial piety.
So the news arrives in waves. First, word comes from Xian Yun. Her young husband has fallen suddenly and violently ill. The doctors are saying it might turn into tuberculosis.
Which was essentially a death sentence.
Yeah, the prognosis is grim. If it's TB, he might have 4 or 5 years to live, but his life is effectively over. Xian Yun is completely inconsolable, weeping endlessly.
Notice how the text handles this, though. It is presented as a tragic, heavy fact, but the family cannot absorb it. Their emotional and administrative bandwidth is entirely consumed by the matriarch's failing pulse. It barely registers. It's just background noise.
But the second piece of news demands attention, and it is horrifying. Word arrives regarding Yun Chun, the second sister of the family. She's been married off to a man named Sun Xiaozu, and the source makes it extremely clear this man is a monster.
A literal monster.
He is horribly physically abusing her. A servant from that household comes to the Jia family, literally begging for a doctor. She reports that Ying Chen is crying all night, her throat is blocked with phlegm, and her husband's family outright refuses to treat her. They are torturing her to death.
The social commentary of the source material becomes razor sharp right here. Ying Chen is a daughter of this grand house, married for barely a year, yet she has essentially been sold into domestic torture.
And the family's response is utterly paralyzing. The servant comes begging for help. And the family's first instinct is to hide the news from grandmother Jia so she doesn't get upset.
They want to protect the matriarch from the bad news.
Yeah, they try to hush the servant up. Grandmother Jia overhears it anyway, but then nothing happens. Shortly after this desperate plea, word arrives that Ying Chen has died, and they allow the abusive husband's family to hastily conclude the funeral arrangements without any intervention.
It's devastating.
Now, wait a minute. This family still has immense social power and wealth, even if it's declining, right? Why are they paralyzed by a dying grandmother when a daughter of the house is actively being murdered? Are they just heartless?
It is not that they lack emotion. I mean, the text notes that the women weep upon hearing the news. The paralysis is entirely legal and social, which makes it even more tragic.
Oh, so.
They are bound by the absolute strictures of filial piety. In this societal structure, the highest moral duty, the absolute center of gravity, is the eldest living ancestor. Every single ounce of resources, both financial and emotional, must be directed toward the matriarch.
Oh, wow.
To leave her bedside to deal with a younger sister's abuse, even fatal abuse, would be considered a severe moral failing. It would be a breach of cosmic and social order.
So the system literally demands that you ignore the murder of the young to comfort the natural passing of the old.
Precisely. The hierarchy dictates that the illness of the apex elder supersedes the suffering of anyone beneath her. Ying Chun's tragedy is swallowed by the system. The family's resources are monopolized, and so her death becomes merely an administrative footnote. It's handled hastily by her abusers because the Jia family cannot legally or socially spare the capital to intervene.
That systemic paralysis regarding a murdered daughter is the exact same mechanism that suddenly hypermobilizes the men of the family to plan a funeral.
Yes, the contrast is jarring.
The emotional paralysis contrasts so sharply with the hyper-organized, almost corporate way the family approaches the impending death of the matriarch herself. This brings us to the collision of spiritual detachment and the absolute business of death.
We see two extreme opposing reactions to the impending collapse of the household in this section.
First, we get a visit from Yao Yu. She is an eccentric nun who lives in the family's private garden. While everyone else is weeping or running around in a panic, Miao Yu casually drops by. And her appearance is striking.
The visual details are so important here.
The text details her outfit very specifically. She's wearing a moon white silk jacket, a waterfield patterned vest, and an autumn leaf colored belt. She is dressed vividly in the midst of a death watch.
To understand the significance of this, we have to look at the sumptuary laws and cultural expectations of mourning attire in this era. Mourning requires strict visual uniformity, you know, unbleached hemp, white silk, the removal of all color and ornament to signal collective grief.
Right. Everyone is supposed to look the same to show they're all mourning together.
Exactly. By wearing an autumn leaf belt and a patterned vest, Mao Yu is actively rebelling against the mandated visual uniformity of the household's grief. Her clothing is a visual representation of her spiritual bypass.
She talks to one of the younger sisters, Shi Chun, and essentially says, "I come and go as I please. I don't care about your rules." She even refuses to eat the family's food while she's there. She demonstrates absolute detachment from the family's suffering.
Miao Yu represents the extreme end of spiritual isolationism. She has insulated herself so thoroughly in her religious identity that she has severed her basic human empathy. She views the family's suffering as worldly attachments that she is superior to.
It's a very cold, sterile form of purity.
It really is.
Now, contrast that sterile purity with Wang Shifeng, also known as Phoenix. If Miao Yu is floating above it all, Shifeng is in the mud, frantically turning the gears.
Xi Feng is such a fascinating character here.
She is actually severely ill herself, right?
Yeah.
Like, she is bedridden. But she knows that her own status, her remaining power in the family, depends entirely on her administrative competence during a crisis. So despite her illness, she drags her dying body out of bed to oversee the arrangements.
Xi Feng understands that the grief is private, but the mourning is a high-stakes public performance. A failure in funeral logistics is a failure of filial piety, and that translates directly to a loss of political and social power for the family in the eyes of the capital.
The cinematic pacing of this section is incredible. It just cuts back and forth. Inside the bedroom, tears, last breaths, desperate prayers. Outside in the hallways, the men, Jia Zhang and Jia Lian, are secretly running a massive logistics operation.
They're treating it like a military campaign.
They really are. Jia Zhang is whispering urgent orders. Go measure everyone for mourning clothes. Get the exact dimensions of the coffin wood. Hire the musicians and the procession flag bearers. Tell the kitchen staff to prepare for a massive influx of guests.
It's all about the optics.
They are secretly measuring themselves for mourning outfits while the woman is still breathing in the next room.
They cannot control the fact that she is dying, so they obsessively control the fabric measurements, the coffin dimensions, the caterers. The hiring of flag bearers and musicians isn't just about honoring the dead. It's about projecting strength to their political rivals.
Yeah, they have to look like they're still in charge.
Exactly. They manage the event because they cannot manage the loss.
But there is a massive problem funding. The men are whispering about how to pay for all this, because the family is secretly going broke. Jia Lian points out that they don't actually need to worry about the funeral expenses, because Grandmother Jia herself secretly saved her own money to pay for it.
This is the most damning indictment of the family's economic reality. We have to look at the economics of the Jia household here. The communal treasury is completely hollowed out.
It highlights that even the matriarch, the most powerful person in the house, knew she couldn't rely on the collective treasury. She knew the family was functionally bankrupt.
She saw the writing on the wall.
She had to skim and hide her own wealth, creating a secret exit fund just to guarantee she got a proper burial. It shows that in this highly structured communal family, you are actually completely alone when it matters most.
The hidden funeral fund is proof that the social contract within the family has already been broken. The system is running on fumes and hidden cash.
And just as all these grand secret preparations are being finalized, just as the tailors are cutting the cloth and the coffin wood is being selected, the matriarch does something completely unexpected. We enter the final moments, the phenomenon of terminal lucidity.
The sudden surge of energy before the end?
Yes. The doctor warns the man that her pulse is failing. The end is minutes away. The family rushes to prepare her burial clothes. They are standing around the bed waiting for the final breath. And suddenly, Grandmother Jia opens her eyes.
It's such a dramatic shift.
She looks around. She asks for tea. Her daughter-in-law tries to give her ginseng soup, which is a powerful restorative medicine, a symbol of fighting the illness. But Jia mother rejects the ginseng. She says, no, I just want tea. She drinks the tea. She asks for another sip. And then, shockingly, she demands to sit up.
Wow.
She tells them, I want to sit up. And I want to talk to you.
The rejection of the ginseng is incredibly symbolic here. By refusing the restorative medicine, she is rejecting the illusion of a cure. She's accepting the reality of her death.
Right. She's not pretending anymore.
Exactly. But by demanding to sit up, she is reasserting her absolute authority one final time. She refuses to die as a passive patient lying on her back. She intends to die as a commander holding court. She is controlling the exact posture of her departure.